Right, so once again, this next segment comes with a trigger warning for those of you who are afraid of snakes or who get the creeps listening to them being spoken about. Please go and pour yourself a cup of tea and just turn down the volume for a few minutes, because we are going to be discussing reptiles for the remainder of this hour, but with good reason. It's always a pleasure to have with us in studio herpetologist Tyrone Ping. He's the man who gave a cobra a bubble bath. Remember that story? More importantly, though, he is one of our leading snake gurus in the Western Cape, you can say. He's the author of the book Snakes and Other Reptiles of the Western Cape, and he's now spent nearly 20 years documenting and photographing not only snakes, but other reptiles as well. He's authored field guides and scientific papers. He really, really cares about them, and he cares about protecting them. And he's going to be giving a talk in that light on Monday evening to the Cape Horticultural Society. Now, it's going to be at the Athenaeum in Newlands. I will give you more information at the end of the interview. But we thought, knowing that he's in that mindset, ready to talk next week, let's get a bit of a sneak preview. Tyrone, it's great to have you with us again.
Pippa, thanks so much for having me again. Good
sure.
to see you.
I always ask you every time I see you, had any interesting snake rescues recently? I don't know if anything's ever going to top the bubble bath. But
the bubble, you know what, every snake sort of encounter and rescue is always different. It's always exciting. I had a call just last week in Tambours Kloof. Someone watched a puff adder go from their deck outside, straight across the living room floor and under the bookcase where it sat, and they called me. Quick and easy, under the bookcase, into the tube, and that was it.
And off you. And what do you do with them after you've caught them?
So everyone always asks this, and it's always the same question. I'll just say, well, I can release it wherever you want me to. If you've got a neighbor you don't like, just kidding. No, of course, the most important thing for us is obviously we want to remove the snake from your home or your garden so your pets, your young children aren't in danger. And of course, the well-being of the snake. So you always want to release the snake as close to as possible as where it was found. For example, you don't want to catch a snake in Camps Bay and release it in Cormackie, for example.
Okay.
It's just not good, and it's typically quite unethical sort of catch and removal. So we're quite fortunate here in around the city of Cape Town. We've got loads of mountains, loads of big green open spaces. So even around the suburbs, there's, you know, within a kilometer away, you've got Table Mountain National Park. You've got green spaces where the snakes can safely go into.
Okay. So that makes a lot of sense as well. I mean, as you said, you want to protect the creature itself, not just the people that it poses any kind of risk to. So return it to as close as possible to where home was. It would be like finding a kidnapped child and dropping it off on the side of the road in a different suburb and expecting it to find its way home. Would be very uncalled for. So I'm glad you take that approach. Now, the question of the day is really whether that kind of work tapers off into the winter months. I think a lot of people know snake activity. They associate in their head winter months, reptiles. Do they hibernate? Do they just get a bit more sluggish? They know that you're not as likely to encounter them in your day-to-day walking around. It doesn't mean they're not still there, though, Tyrone.
Exactly that. And it's almost a big fallacy here in South Africa, Southern Africa, most of the subcontinent, you know. There's snakes. It doesn't get cold enough for snakes to actually hibernate like they do in North America and Europe. You know, we don't have long enough periods of frost and ice.
Right.
So the snake activity is certainly far less during the winter months than it is in the summer, primarily because snakes aren't feeding as much in the winter.
Okay.
For example, snakes, obviously being ectothermic animals, they need warmth, they need the sun to sort of get energy to digest their food and so on. So if you think about this, a snake's not going to eat in the middle of the pouring rain. It's not going to be able to find anything to eat, but it's not going to want to eat in freezing cold conditions. It doesn't have the energy to look for prey, and then it doesn't have the energy to digest the food. And if they're unable to digest the food sort of sits in the gut, and, you know, the snake has to then obviously vomit that or regurgitate it, for lack of a better word. Otherwise, they can actually begin to decompose within the snake, which, of course, can cause all sorts of complications.
That's fascinating. Okay, so they really do need some sunlight, a little bit of warmth.
A little bit of warmth.
To actually kickstart and carry on the process of actually digesting the food.
Exactly.
Which would explain why, then, when you do have a beautiful, sunny, wintry day, as we so often do, you've got to be careful because they'll come out and bask in the sun quite deliberately, won't they?
Exactly that. Yeah. They come out and bask in open places, places like Rondebosch Common here in the suburbs. You'll often see the mole snakes in the long grass in the winter just outside of their burrows, catching a little bit of sun. Once that little piece of the body warms up, they'll go around back into the burrow, and then the back half of the snake gets a bit of sun, and then they slink back into the burrow. So they're certainly not nearly as active. You just don't see a lot of snake activity. But if you go looking for them, so as I do and as many of my colleagues do, you do find often what you're looking for. But if you're just generally walking out of the mountain or, you know, sitting in the garden having a bra on a Sunday afternoon in the winter, you're very unlikely to come across more snakes.
Okay, so if you are out walking on Rondebosch Common and you come across the loop of the mole snake sticking out the hole, I assume you just leave it untouched and just keep your dogs away.
Yeah, you get safe distance, care, and walk away. They're not going to, snakes are never going to come out there and attack you. There's always this big fallacy of, you know, if I go walking on the mountain, is a snake going to jump out the bush or drop from a tree and sort of attack you? Snakes just don't attack people. It just doesn't happen.
It's really, you have to literally almost stand on them or really catch them in a position where they feel threatened for them to really engage with you.
That's exactly that. Often with the snakes, it's more of a reaction and a reactive thing. They want to get away. They don't want to deal with people. They don't want to deal with dogs and cats and so on. So they essentially trying to defend themselves. So if it means getting away, they'll get away. If they can't get away, they're going to sort of stand up and, you know, try divert the attention.
Just as a side note to the snakes on Rondebosch Common, if you happen to want to get away in the direction of the mugger who's been at work for the last week and perhaps scare them off, we'd be grateful. All I'm saying. Tyrone Ping is my guest in studio, and we're talking about snakes and other reptiles in winter in particular. If you've got questions for him, you're very welcome to send a WhatsApp to 0725671567 and ask away. We're so lucky when we do have not raining winter days. We have beautiful winter days. Lots of people will still be out there on the mountain and exploring. And there are quite a number of different species that they can encounter up there, even though they might not be as active and out there as usual. Tyrone, remind me of the numbers. How many different species of snake do we have in the Western Cape? And how many of those are the kind that can be dangerous in human encounters?
So in the Western Cape, we only have about 42 species of snakes. So it sounds, I say only, other parts of the country, some of the provinces have got up to 92, 95 species. So we already have a very small percentage of those. So if we look at just the greater city of Cape Town, for example, we only really have three highly venomous snakes we need to worry about.
Okay.
That is obviously the Cape Cobra, goes without saying, the Puff Adder and the Boomslang. Those are highly venomous snakes, which, of course, a bite would be a medical emergency.
Yeah.
And I say those are the top three most dangerous. Things like Boomslang, for example, they stay in the trees. You generally don't see them. So on a danger value, not very high. But, of course, if you happen to get bitten by them, completely different story.
Okay. Speaking of Boomslang, I saw footage on social media yesterday of an absolutely enormous Boomslang with the most brilliant yellow sort of undercarriage I had ever laid eyes on. And a lot of people were commenting underneath, you know, that the colouring was so exquisite, but that the snake was so much bigger than you expect a Boomslang to be. Do we get them that size here in Cape Town?
We do, yeah. The Boomslang can usually average, an average size Boomslang about 1.5 metres.
Okay.
They can reach to the upside of about 1.8, in extreme cases, hit that 2 meter mark. But that's quite a rare occasion.
Okay. We've been so focused on the snakes. Let's give the other reptiles their moment in the sun, as it were. I mean, Tyrone, I know, I mean, I've been seeing from your social media recently, you've been doing a lot about the little geckos and the lizards and the frogs are not reptiles, I know, but the other creepies of their kind. Do they also have sort of reduced activity in the winter months like the snakes do?
So one of the best parts about the Western Cape, particularly here in the greater city of Cape Town, obviously with winter rains being a thing, whereas in the eastern parts of the country you have summer rainfall.
Yeah.
So in the other parts of the country, your frogs and reptiles are all buzzing at the same time.
Yeah.
Here in the Cape, it's fantastic because as the reptiles quieten down, the frogs suddenly surge with all the rain.
Yeah.
So my activity shifts from, you know, taking out cobras out of people's homes and, you know, trapping around in the felt looking for dangerous animals, to spending many, many cold, wet, damp, freezing, windy winter evenings photographing and looking for frogs.
And are our frogs generally doing okay? We know the Western leopard toad is an ongoing source of concern, and people do amazing things in Noatuk to try and help them cross roads and get to breeding grounds and make sure that they're protected. Are the rest of the amphibians also in danger? I mean, they're subject to the same kind of threats as the leopard toad is.
Exactly. And with some of the frogs, with the sort of landscape of the Western Cape, you've got all these beautiful mountain ranges. You've got a lot of frogs that are highly endemic. So you only find them on a certain, you know, southern-facing slope of a certain mountain. So those animals are extremely vulnerable to things like fires, things like the exotic pine plantations that are sort of, you know, popping up all over the mountains. And, you know, those, of course, drain a lot of the water. And, of course, these little frogs need the seeps and the moisture of the mountain. So these invasive trees are now taking the moisture away of the seeps and sort of swampy areas that these frogs live in. If we look at Table Mountain, for example, there's the Table Mountain ghost frog, which is endemic to, off the top of my head, 6 or 7 streams on Table Mountain.
Gosh.
And that's the only place where it occurs. So
Wow.
fortunately, it's in a protected area, but who knows what could happen upstream. You know, if we think make more dams or sort of interrupt what happens on the top of the mountain, that flows down and affects what happens in the streams, things like silt buildup and so on. So frogs are an extremely tough time in general.
And how about our little lizards and geckos? We seem to have a lot of geckos in the house this past summer, for which I was grateful because it means a reduction in the mosquito population. But do they also get active at this time of year?
Yeah, so the little geckos and lizards, they are far more sort of acceptable of the cooler temperatures. Like if I'm sure many of the listeners would have been up Table Mountain, you see there those black lizards always sitting on the rocks in the southern rock agamas. People often call them blue-headed lizards or cojomandas with the bright blue heads. And they'll, again, as soon as the sun comes out on a warm day, you'll see them basking out on the rocks. And they too, in cold winter and poorer conditions, they sit in the rock crevices, hide under rocks. And should a warm day come out, and they'll pop out and bask away.
Okay, so if you're out on a sunny day, expect to see them out there and just leave them to do their sunbathing. It's quite a lot more important, their kind of sunbathing, than ours is. It's about digesting their food, not just getting a tan. Right, we've got some listeners asking questions, so let me dive in here. Firstly, somebody's saying, if you have moles inside your garden, does that mean they're likely to be mole snakes nearby?
So many people would think so, but what people don't realize is if you've got a tiny little garden, you know, and you might have three or four moles living in the yard, it doesn't necessarily mean there'll be moles there, because once the mole snake has visited there and eaten two, three of your mole populations, where does he go? Because the suburbs, most of the gardens are heavily fenced with roads, there's not a lot of ways that these snakes can move around.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very unlikely that you'll have a large, I mean, mole snakes can get to about 2 meters. So it's very unlikely you're going to have a giant mole snake just living in your garden.
And I would imagine, I mean, once it's eaten all the moles, it's going to need to move on to find food somewhere else. And B, does word get around the mole population that there's a resident snake and this isn't a happy place to be living?
No, it doesn't. Fortunately for the moles, all the snakes, either way.
And then John asking, please ask your guest if it's true that a baboon will easily kill a snake.
Baboons are usually quite afraid of snakes.
Okay.
And often you'll see footage of them foraging where they turn over rocks looking for insects. You'll see them, they'll turn over a rock, the next minute they drop the rock and they all scatter. So baboons and monkeys in general, monkeys and snakes, baboons, they don't mix well.
Okay, so probably a little bit of urban legend woven into
A little bit of urban legend, because I mean, a baboon's going to know, you know, certain animals are dangerous and they're not going to want to put themselves in the firing line when they can just easily escape.
Absolutely. Okay, you've got about 5 minutes to ask a question if you'd like to. Tyrone Ping with us in studio, author of Snakes and Other Reptiles of the Western Cape. If you would like to ask a question, send a WhatsApp to 072-567-1567, or you can tweet me at PJC Hudson. An important question coming through. Thank you, Emma. Are anti-venom supplies fully restored? I think the last time we chatted, there was a shortage. There had been a major backup and delay in manufacturing of anti-venom. As far as you know, are we back on track?
We're back on track.
Okay.
The anti-venom supply generally just ebbs and flows, as with many other things in our country. Sometimes the supply is sort of stipend when there's load shedding, when there's big power outages and that sort of thing. So it does sort of ebb and flow. It does, however, always seem that when we need it the most, in the start of the snake bite season, that supply is down. But we should, I mean, people, it's always a hot topic of conversation, anti-venom. But the reality is, not a lot of people are getting bitten by highly venomous snakes. Snake bites are a very rare occurrence in South Africa. Just to sort of put some of the listeners at ease, because whenever I go to homes and find snakes, people have said, oh, we're so fortunate we didn't get bitten. I said, getting bitten is the tiniest percentile chance. You have to, you know, be really unlucky and just be in the wrong place at the wrong time for it to happen.
I mean, remind us, have you been bitten before?
By nothing by anything dangerous. Right, I use all the safety methods and the tools at my disposal. It's not worth the risk.
And if the man who literally handles them for a living isn't getting bitten, that also tells you something. You know, if they were literally going out there and deliberately attacking, I would expect you to be rolling up your sleeves and showing me scar marks everywhere today. Another listener, first let's do this. Nigel in the Strand saying, I've always had the silver big lizards in my garden and all of a sudden I don't see them anymore. For the past year or so, my garden is crawling with little skinks. I'm not quite sure what the big silver lizards are that he might be referring to. But
you and I both. Yeah. I am familiar with the skinks. It might just be a different variety or color variety of the little skinks.
Right.
But I mean, populations do ebb and flow, particularly in the suburbs when you've got things like cats and pets. You know, you might have had a neighbor move into the neighborhood who's got a free roaming cat, and it might spend its day sort of innocently hunting these little lizards. And in a period of a month, 2 months, 6 months, it can actually decimate these little populations of lizards. And you often don't, you don't notice one going missing, two going missing. And you might sit and be like, oh, it's been 6 months since we saw a lizard.
I haven't seen one, yeah.
Yeah. So that does happen quite often.
Okay.
Unfortunately.
Somebody also asking about chameleons, saying they seem to be so scarce. Again, we've had lots of conversations about the threats to chameleons on the show. Chameleon populations are a worry, aren't they?
They certainly are. And yeah. Just purely based on habitat, if you go to particular areas, wild flare type areas, nature reserves, chameleons are so abundant. Mm-hmm. And you know, people can't believe it. I often visit nature reserves in places like Grassy Park, where yeah. you can just walk during the day and see scores and scores of chameleons. But it's all about how you look for them and how you see them. Often with chameleons, when I do these talks at the Horticultural Society and the Botanical Society, yeah. a lot of the older guests will say, oh, they used to see loads of chameleons in the 70s and 80s, yeah. you know, when they were growing up. And I laugh and I say, well, back then you were playing outside, you were running around. Now, like most of us, we're stuck in the office during the day. So you're not spending as much time outside as you should.
Fair point.
So the chameleons are still around. It's just they are quite threatened with sort of the sort of developments of the city, you know, yep. more housing estates, more clearing for land, for apartments and so on and so forth.
And the breaking up of sort of green routes for them to move from one area
That's
to another,
exactly,
affecting
yes.
everything from the bees to the birds to the snakes and the lizards and chameleons as well. Now, before we run out of time, we must tell everybody where to find you for the next talk at the Horticultural Society. If you feel like you've only scratched the surface of Tyrone's knowledge, absolutely we have, because we've only had 15 minutes, but you get a bigger chunk of his time on Monday evening, the 6th of May. He is giving a talk at the Cape Horticultural Society about the fascinating snakes and reptiles of Cape Town. And if you would like to attend, it's at 7:30 at the Athenaeum in Newlands. He's going to be looking at some of the common species, ones we've mentioned today, as well as some of the lesser known ones, with a big focus on how they can be protected. You don't have to book in advance. You can simply arrive at the Athenaeum. If you are a member of the Horticultural Society, your access is free, but visitors, you're asked to pay 30 rand, which can simply be paid at the door. If you do need more information than that, the best thing to do is reach out to the Society directly, info@capehorticulturalsociety.co.za. Tyrone, is your book still available widely in bookstores as well?
It's still available. We've just reprinted a whole bunch of more copies. It's been really well received, so I'm really grateful that people have been supporting the project.
Fantastic, and really grateful to have had you with us in studio sharing your epic knowledge with us again. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much, Viva.
Tyrone Ping, and remember to look for him on social media if you want to see daily doses of adorable reptiles and cute ones, as well as the scary ones.